We're going to hear not McLuhan. We're going to hear Ted Carpenter give a speech, McLuhan's main colleague in the 60s and 50s. He's going to give a speech at Fordham in 1968. He was there with McLuhan during McLuhan's Albert Schweitzer chair. So here we go.
...the task of trying to summarize the first semester's course for those of you who were not present, and to try to bring many of the points together for those of you who were. And beginning at our next meeting, we will then proceed to new material, or rather an expansion of material that's been discussed. Now, this is a course in communication, and originally it was thought that man became man when he developed language. The notion of man without language seemed like a contradiction in terms. It was firmly believed that language was what set man apart from all other beings. And language was equated with speech. And writing was thought to be simply a recording of speech. It was thought then that if one knew the origin of language, one would know the origin of man. And this problem was of such interest to the 19th century that we have an entire library on the subject, on the origin of language, and yet we have no evidence on which these speculations were based. The problem became so pronounced that I think it was in 1906, the Academy in France passed a standing rule prohibiting the reading of papers on the origin of language. Now, the fact is, we know almost nothing about the origin of speech. Anthropologists don't always admit this to undergraduates, but among themselves, when they're not trying to impress anyone, they will acknowledge that we don't know whether language, that is, speech, dates from 1 million years ago or 500,000 or 50,000. Now, it was once, as I said, rather loosely believed that man was simply an alienated ape who became erect and immediately commenced talking. And this early walkie-talkie was supposed to roam several continents, making tools that remained remarkably unchanged over a period of several 100,000 years. And yet he was credited with fully developed speech. Now, today it all seems far more complicated, largely as a result of some of the studies that have been made in etiology, the work of people like Conrad Lorenz, as well as somatology. And it's recently been suggested, for example, that language emerged out of a wordless but not soundless ritual. Something like Eliot's, "The word within a word, unable to speak a word, swaddled in darkness." Alan Lomax, from a study of ethnic song, concluded the song is danced speech. Song might also be called speech slowed down. Or possibly we could say that speech is ritual speeded up. Just as writing is speech speeded up. It's speed writing, as it were. Now, Bess Hawes, from the study of African folk songs, noted that the underlying principle is an unheard beat, like an orchestra in which nobody plays the tune because everybody hears it. The underlying beat is a motor beat, and the music is danced, executed, standing still. What I'm suggesting to you here, then, is that possibly man was man before the development of speech. It's entirely possible that people were able to communicate and communicate many very fundamental emotions and ideas and states of mind without a coherent speech pattern. What they presumably had was a ritual form in which the entire body communicated. Now, if we're prepared to accord this, then the dignity of the title language, we must recognize the fact that it is pattern. Man is everywhere the great pattern maker, the great pattern perceiver. I don't care how difficult his situation, how tormented, he cannot live in chaos. And everywhere he imposes form, and the form that he imposes is structure. These are models, as it were. These are like mathematical equations that work. Now, we may not always be aware of the models that underlie human behavior. We can often obey these laws without being conscious of these laws, specifically conscious of them. We only become conscious of them when they're broken, or when we abandon them, when we can see them, when they're obsolete. But when we live them, they are essentially part of ourselves, and we're oblivious to them. We're almost paralyzed by them, in the sense that you can't smell yourself, and you can't see the patterns you follow, as long as you're obedient to them. But my point is simply this, that if we must ask then, when did man become man? That is, a unique being separated from lower animals, no longer dependent upon instinct, no longer relying upon nature's guarantee of some built-in mechanism that's in the germplasm, but someone capable of communicating, creating his own world. It's entirely possible that this occurred before the development of verbal speech. Now, I think the reason we are becoming aware of this today and are fascinated by this possibility, a possibility that never occurred to anthropologists 40 years ago or even 20 years ago, is that today we've witnessed a great retreat from language. Where once it was thought that everything under heaven and earth could be expressed in verbal categories, now we're not so sure. And now we begin to recognize that there are multiple languages, that we live in a Tower of Babel. That there are categories, mathematical categories, that are totally untranslatable into speech. And these are nonetheless absolutely coherent. As a matter of fact, they give us a greater, more precise view of reality than language does. But the notion of wordless thinking long seemed like an absolute contradiction. And the notion that ritual might be structured and that it might be capable of two things, and I'd like to make this point clear. We tend to think of language as serving simply as a means of communication, of taking knowledge and going from the knower to the unknower. And we see it simply as a Western Union thing between these two. But language can serve another function, and ritual can serve another function. And that is the power not to transmit from mind to mind, but to create mind. That is, language can serve as a positive force, a creative force, bringing something new into existence. Now, poets tend to use language in this way. They use it for effect, not for the transmission of information. And I believe ritual essentially has this purpose. It is a creative thing. It does not lead to a product. It does not have a goal. It is not concerned with communication in the sense that we're using it in this classroom, of having something here and transmitting it there. But on the contrary, by juxtaposing and superimposing different images, you create something new. Now this type of thing, of course, is abhorrent to the academician. He regards this often as a misuse of language, as a perversion of ritual, and he's not prepared to accord, let us say, a practitioner of this, membership in a college faculty. We don't have dancers in the college faculty. We insist on the analytical method. We believe that the classroom is a place for the transmission of knowledge, not the creation of mind or new knowledge. Yet it may well be that the main function of ritual then is not one of simple communication from A to B, but on the contrary, the production, the creation of something. Now, I think to go back to the point of this retreat from language, I regard this as one of the most fascinating features of our time. It's not, I don't sense it here in New York, but it's very much evident in California, where students speak far less and often have the greatest difficulty in articulating forms, not because they are indifferent to language, and not because meaning escapes them, but because they are insensitive to word order and the rather naive notions of causality and temporality which are everywhere implied in grammar. And if you pull back then from formal grammar, then you pull away from the very structuring principles that give you coherency there, the sequence of subject to verb to object. And I believe the hesitation that so many young people have in speaking today, the stammering, the twisted phrases, arise from the condition not of ignorance, certainly, and not of indifference to speech, but of a recognition that the formal categories of speech are no longer adequate to transmit or to convey or to create those things which they have in mind or that they feel. Now, the synthesis of understanding, which once made common speech possible, today no longer exists. There are large areas of meaning that are ruled by nonverbal categories. Nonverbal languages such as mathematics, a symbolic language. And little, for example, is verbal in modern music or modern art. Both are languages, yet nothing can be said of either that's pertinent to the traditions, traditional notions of linguistic modes. When we ask the contemporary artist to explain himself, he refers us back to his work. He's reluctant to translate his efforts into words, that is, into a wholly different medium. He's unwilling to make another statement. Essentially, what we're saying to him is, we don't understand you, or we don't like that statement. Will you make another statement? But we don't cast it this way. We automatically assume that words can describe anything. Now, it was possible in the Renaissance, of course, to describe a painting. One could say of Rembrandt, a man with a golden helmet. But there's absolutely nothing that can be said about a Franz Klein painting that will even give us a shadow of the substance. A de Kooning seems to go right to the nerve ends. And words simply get in the way here. Language deals only with surface appearances of things. And the rest, and presumably the much larger part, is silence. The space-time continuum of relativity, the atom structure of all matter, the wave-particle state of energy, these are no longer accessible through the word. Reality now begins, for the scientist, outside verbal categories. Now, I don't think since Babel have words and ideas clashed in such a protesting combination. And the current situation is complicated even more by the rebirth of ritual, which, though its origins are presumably much older than print, older than speech, nevertheless lay dormant for about 2,500 years under literacy. Now, both pre-literate and post-literate ritual are highly involving, and what involves surrounds. Thus, it's not enough to say of X-ray art that it shows both the inside and the outside of a figure simultaneously. The question is, what does it mean to go right inside a thing, to be in the belly of the beast? Well, I suspect it's something like Alice going through the looking glass, or a Zuni patient who steps into the sand painting. The shaman, having created this magnificent painting, the sand and colors, reaches out without hesitation, takes the hand of the patient, she steps forward, and she steps into the painting, and he rolls her in the painting. She goes past the vanishing point, as it were, into the art. One enters then and becomes one with what is portrayed. And one goes right inside and takes over temporarily. One comes then to know a thing by being inside it. You get an inside view. You step into the skin of the beast, and that, of course, is precisely what the costume dancer does. He puts on the beast. Now, I think much the same can be said of the electronic environment. Where we're constantly being bombarded by these images that go right inside us. Did you see the headlines the other day that an increasing number of color television sets are recognized as dangerous? They are all X-ray forms. They go inside. And it is no longer us looking at the images, but the images are now projected on us. We have become the screen. We're all sort of like the Lord of the Flies, just covered with these flickering images, surrounded by it. We are inside, and the lights surround us. The whole world has become a happening, a light show. It's what James Joyce called the charge of the light brigade. Now, McLuhan has pointed out that people don't read newspapers. They step into them, the way you step into a bath. You put it on. You step into the news. And today, art is put on art. It's the experience of entering a Bridget Riley walk-in. Step right in, begins Alan Caprow. Or it's a ritual where everyone participates in art. When I am in my painting, said Jackson Pollock. Now, at most, words play only an integral part of ritual, and at times they simply get in the way. Certainly, ritual is not ordered and ruled by words or the grammars of either speech or print. Now, artists and poets and children and tribesmen and filmmakers find it much easier to accept a phrase like wordless thinking when applied to ritual than scholars who will admit to two languages only, verbal and mathematical. And for them, the analytical mode of thought alone is synonymous with intelligence. They're reluctant, for example, I know this is a very painful experience. They're reluctant to accept a jazz player on a university faculty. Seven years ago, I was given an opportunity to establish two departments jointly, an anthropological one and a film production one. And for every PhD in anthropology, we matched it with a creative artist. We had a dancer. We had Fred Katz, the jazz composer. Chico Hamilton worked there. And we had Bo Cannon, the animator. And we found that magnificent things occurred in the classroom and elsewhere by putting these things together. However, the whole thing ended in a ghastly tragedy because the academician simply could not accept people who were employing a non-analytical method. Eight of them were fired in one sweep. The whole thing went to court, nasty fight, and this sort of thing. But really what was at stake, other than the fact that just simply SOBs who ran the place, was that the academic world is deeply rooted in print, in the bias of print. And the absolute insistence that only the grammar and the basic assumptions of print are acceptable. Only these forms can give you truth. The one possible exception that they will admit to is mathematics, but they tuck the physical scientists off to the side as sort of a vulgar and unlettered technicians. But the notion that there might be other languages, other modes to truth, other ways to enter being and reality, they just will not conceive. Now, speech, emerging from ritual, retained much of ritual's multi-sensory character. And in the tribal world, where the eye listens, and the ear sees, and all of the senses assist each other in concert, speech is a kind of a multi-layered concert, a symphony of the senses, where our five and country senses assist one another. Eliot reminds us of this when he says that a word can be a poem. Now, writing meant a translation of this many-layered concert into the sense of sight alone. And reading and writing in this respect represent an intense degree of specialization of experience. Writing meant that the acoustic world, with its magical power over the being of things, was arrested and banished in the very humble sphere. And writing meant the power of fixing the flux of words and thought. Writing permitted analysis of thought processes that gave rise to the division of knowledge. And with writing came the power of visually enclosing not only acoustic space, but architectural space. And before writing, all of these divisions merged into a single knowledge, a single rhythm, of which all was present, now, sort of an eternal now. Now, the manuscript retained many of these qualities of oral speech. You know, nothing could have been more alien to medievalism than silent reading. All reading was allowed. Was done standing up with gesture and song, even dance. The carols were like telephone booths. They were there to cut down the sound. Otherwise, there would have been mumbling and singing everywhere in distraction. Now, a child learns to separate his senses when he learns to read. When he learns to read silently, without even the lips moving, and his legs will twist and he bites down and he grabs that pencil butt by an incredible tour de force, he learns the most remarkable thing. Not classroom discipline, but he learns how to separate one sense from another. He learns how to turn on one sense and keep the others in neutral so that he can see but not use the other senses. To me, the most extreme case of this is the marksman, who even covers one eye. covers his ears, cuts down everything. And he uses the rifle as an extension of the eye. Now, we finally end up with the librarian who posts the sign, silence, and the concert goer who closes his eyes, and the gallery guard who warns, do not touch. Rarely would you find a man equally gifted in more than one field of art during this illiterate period. Someone like William Blake comes to mind simply as the exception. Who reads Da Vinci's poetry today? Who's interested in Wagner's plays? We expect one man to concentrate on the single experience of the single sense by the single person. Now, print accelerated what writing began. And the eye was no longer primary, it became dominant. And this visual emphasis was twofold. The nature of the eye is such that it fragments the field of observation. The scientist does not look at the world with wide eyes. He focuses, he pinpoints, he abstracts, he takes one thing at a time and he arranges them sequentially in a train, a bumper-to-bumper arrangement, sort of teardropper fashion. And he will isolate one element from another. And he'll force everything else into the subliminal. You know, Freud thought that the unconscious and the subliminal had their origin because of fear of sex. Peanuts compared to what print did. Printing forced the whole sensory order, save one sense, the sense of sight, forced everything, not just sex, everything into the unconscious. And how natural that the Renaissance would paint people in this way. A beam of light coming down, illuminating the nose, the cheeks, a few elements, chin, and so forth, but everything else in darkness. Now, there's a second factor that comes with the bias of print. The eye emphasizes observable, measurable, material things, and it deals with their external surfaces, their outer appearances. The non-material was translated linguistically into the material. Such basic psychological states as tendency, duration, intensity, all of these things I have to describe physically. I would say, I use spatial metaphor. I'd say that I cannot come to grips with your argument because it's, how can I grip an argument? Because it's level, it's over my head. And I am losing touch with what you are trying to say, our views being so far apart. It is impossible in the English language to express the most basic psychological states without recourse to spatial metaphor. I say thereafter rather than the logical then after. And now, speech then, or the eye, print, insisted then that we deal with outer surfaces. Let me illustrate this in a very simple way. Mendel published his discoveries in, I think it was 1865, absolutely unnoticed. Totally ignored. He sent reprints of the article to the leading biologists of the time. Darwin and Huxley didn't have a clue as to what this meant. Darwin looked at turtles. His gardener said of him, oh, a nice man, but strange, you know. He'll stand in the garden looking at a flower for over an hour. And the story was widely told in German scholarly circles of some famous biologist who had a student. And the student came to him and said, what is my first assignment? He said, I want you to take this fish and look at it and write down absolutely everything about that fish that you see. And so the student went alone into a room and spent 2 weeks there, and he came out and he said, I have written down everything there is to know about this fish. And the professor said to him, all right, now take it back and spend 2 years there and look. And this was widely applauded, and this was thought, you know, this is how you really approach these things. Today, science has very little interest in the appearance of things. We are concerned with inner structure. We do not care how calcite smells or tastes or looks. We want to know how it reacts to hydrochloric acid. Biology today has become a science largely by the application of mathematical systems to it. Genetics is almost wholly mathematical today. We're not interested in how a being looks, but how it reproduces. We're interested in the inner structure, the invisible form, not how steels and alloys appear, but how they react to certain tests. You know, there was a time when the great masters of finance and capitalism thought that they controlled the world about them because they embraced it in a sensate way. And the American capitalist was generally shown, as he was in fact, as a fat man. He liked food. He liked women. He liked bright art, particularly big news. And he'd be on a yacht. And he'd have a box in the opera, sort of thing. He mastered and controlled the sensate world. He didn't have a clue as to what was coming. Beginning with the First World War, science went underground. Science went through outer appearances and began to deal with the invisible. It went from the track to the trackless, from the visible to the invisible. It went in the whole area of alloys that could not be seen or touched. It had to be experienced through their effects and their reactions to. What I'm suggesting to you then is that not only did the artists like Picasso step inside and employ X-ray vision, but the scientists did as well. And the break comes about 1900. It's surely no accident that Mendel's laws were discovered by three men, almost independent of one another, within a few months of one another. For 35 years, no one could conceive of science other than dealing with the empirical. Why? Because language is rooted in the empirical. And I'd like to stress this point. Language deals with outer surfaces. Language is descriptive. Language deals with the sensate world. And one of the reasons we have now retreated from language is that we are no longer concerned with the empirical. Moreover, we have found that we can know the sensate world without the intermediary force of words. We can do this through art, music. Now, obviously, art and music cannot escape the sensate world because they deal with the senses. But it does not follow that language must be employed to approach them. They can be approached directly. Non-representational art is direct sensory programming without the intermediary of language. I'm going over this material very rapidly. Are there any questions as we go along? Now, speech imitated print, and language retreated still further from ritual. Step by step, language cast off its ritualistic features. It divested itself of all sensory connections, save sight, which it used in a highly specialized, restricted way. The eye of the marksman, the eye of the man holding a fixed position. From where I stand, from my point of view, my position is, it would be like Stalin reviewing troops. Now, as late as the Renaissance, it was still possible to believe that language could enclose within its bounds the sum of human experience, at least human sensate experience. Mathematics was still anchored in the empirical and immaterial experiences, which in turn were ordered and ruled by language. But with the formulation of analytical geometry, the theory of algebraic functions, and the development of calculus, mathematics ceased to be a dependent notation, an instrument of the empirical, and it became an autonomous language, totally untranslatable into speech. Now, mathematics allowed man to escape from language. You see, language yields nothing except a further image of itself. It's an elaborate tautology. Unlike numbers, words do not contain within themselves functional notations or operations. Added or divided, they give only other words or approximations of their meanings. Mathematics broke out of this circle. Now, I think this is why we can say of... That with The rock paintings, let's say the cave paintings of Lascaux, Altamir, that perhaps nothing will ever be done in the field of art that will go beyond them. Even our greatest artist, Picasso, acknowledged that here were their equals. And in the field of arts, then, we do not find the artist standing on his predecessor's shoulders. But the field of science, one builds, one goes on. One does come to know a more accurate reality, and it is mathematics that allows this. Words will not permit it. Words simply take you in a spiral back into language, into reformulations of words, into other reformulations. Now, beginning about 1900, science shifted away from the empirical toward the invisible. And industry immediately applied this technique. It's no coincidence that our writers, that Proust and Joyce should appear at this time, that our artists, beginning School of Paris, 1906, would all begin to break through the empirical, past the sensate, or at least past language. So that our scientists and our poets and our artists had already retreated from language 60 and 70 years ago. How natural then that the populace would begin to pick it up and express it itself in now a reduction in the use of words. Anthropologists have noted again and again that native peoples don't talk much. Language is used sparingly. Not because they have little to say, but because much of what they have to say cannot be expressed in words. My impression is that the same thing is beginning to prevail in our society. We have moved away from language. Now, to many people, this means a breakdown of culture. It means a loss of everything they believe in. They're terrified with this abandonment of the principal technique by which they found themselves and expressed themselves. But I think it's a natural step and a very logical one. We are now beginning to operate and to live in a world, to have a whole new way of being in relation to life, which requires that we employ many languages, of which speech is only one, of which speech has only limited capabilities. The question now is, what can speech do better than any other language, and is it worth doing? What can print do? What can mathematics do? Ritual, many other forms. Now, everything has gone underground and become invisible. Today, even government is invisible. We speak of the CIA as the invisible government. And what could be more natural in a society where truth is regarded as invisible inner structure? In personal terms, the inner trip now supplants outer travel. It's the psychic leap of the 20th century, the one that man's been making now for at least 10 or 15 years. We no longer think of reality as something outside of ourselves, something there to be observed, measured. This concept came with the Greeks, with literacy, and it goes with literacy, with the coming of the electronic world. Once more, after an interval of 2,500 years, reality is conceived as being within one or within another, and the search for truth has once more become this inward trip. Isn't it one of the most fascinating things that in our time, our government is spending all of this time on space travel in which we have no interest? And the real interest, if you can judge by reading material and conversations today, is this reorientation as we become orientalized. It's the psychic trip, the inner search. We no longer tell people that what they need is outside activities. Get interested in outside things. We tell them now get interested in inside things. To look inward. LSD is only a very small portion of this trip. It manifests itself in many ways. I think in the broader sense we might even be able to conceive of television as one huge LSD trip, in which the whole turning inward is the search for an inner reality. Now, language plays little part in the inward trip. Again, words get in the way. Silence is regarded as a higher state, beyond the impurities, the fragmentations of speech, free of the naive logic, the inner conception of time, implicit in print. And with the the application of mathematics and science, coupled with this concern with inner structure, the inner trip, has led scientists away from the empirical and hence away from language. Today, increasing areas of science are being taken over by mathematics. Chemistry today is largely mathematical. Biology, largely. The one area in which this has not worked is in the human sciences, in anthropology and sociology. There are many anthropologists and sociologists who are aiming in this direction. I wish them all kinds of unsuccess. I don't think it'll work. We've been trying it for 118 years now, and no one's come up with even a coherent case of this. For some reason or other, human behavior, at least as we now understand it, just does not lend itself to translation into mathematics. There's a very simple test that you can run in a thing like this. The English public school system originally would train people in language, especially English, by saying, translate this passage from English into Greek. And I'll translate it to Greek back into English, and I'll compare the two versions. And you had to have a fairly close approximation. If you translate human behavior into numbers, can you translate it from numbers back into human behavior? No. So it strikes me that at the moment these two things are untranslatable. Now, numbers are used in a variety of ways in our society. For one thing, they may be used not as numbers but as neutral alphabet. Let me give a very simple illustration of this. The first English census was called the Doomsday Book, not because it was a tax list, but because the entries were visual, not verbal. John Smith written lost many levels of meaning which John Smith spoken retained. And this seemed to threaten the sense of identity of many people. Now, when the telephone companies recently decided to drop the prefix and substitute numbers, granite 7111 became 477111 sort of thing. Again, this upset many people because they found it more difficult to remember. Because numbers cannot evoke. They do not have the memory evocation which speech offers us. Now, people often feel a loss of identity when they are designated by number rather than by name. They say, my name is John Smith, not 4821. I don't like to be an IBM number. And in this context, numbers aren't used as numbers, but as a neutral alphabet, which is simply devoid of all sensory connections or associations. Now, art and music, of course, cannot escape the sensate world. Both are permanently tied to the senses, but neither is permanently tied to language. Where in the Renaissance, just as it was possible to translate mathematics into speech, so it was possible to translate painting into speech. But we can no longer do this. Today, art has ceased to be representational. It no longer represents. It no longer strives to create an illusion of being something other than itself. There's no mystery about it, as it were, in an illusion, an image that is there and not there. But it is a thing in its own way. And what exists there can be a creative statement. It presents. It does not represent. It is a thing. It is not pictorial in the sense of being repertorial. Now, the same can be said of contemporary music, especially electronic music. Contemporary music isn't background music. It's foreground music. It engages our senses directly and requires our participation. This is why with Muzak, what do they give us? They give us old literate music. And this allows people to continue with their activities. If they gave us modern electronic music, they'd find it most disconcerting. People would be engaged and involved in the music. They couldn't get on with their typing. This is why many people turn to the music of a literate age for background. But can you imagine a good, hard Beatle record in a secretarial pool? It would probably cut the production way down. So what they give them is Mozart, muted, buggered up. So that there's no real involvement in quality there. It becomes background. Now, as we become increasingly tribalized in art and outlook and draw closer to native peoples, anthropologists lose one of their best tools. This is the comparative method. But it's built in shock. It's challenge. You know, it was once possible to walk into a class and simply announce that this was the art of this group and this was the sex life of that group. You could always count on shocking people. They'd say, I can't believe it. You mean to tell me people really do this sort of thing? Well, of course, we can't do that anymore because we're all engaged in precisely the same acts. We've all become tribalized. And it seems to me that the anthropologist now, if he wishes to continue with the comparative method, must turn to that which is truly alien from ourselves. He must now turn to the world of print. He must assign not books on the Eskimo or the Swahili, but he must assign Hawthorne and Melville and Tolstoy. And he must begin by saying, you've got to be tolerant. You've got to be patient. You've got to understand that these are people who differ markedly from yourself, but they are human and they are worth knowing. We must make the same preface that we once made for native peoples. Now, history is full of delightful reversals where the opposite of what one predicts comes true. And the question that comes to my mind right now is, where is language, speech, where is print going to survive in this competitive area of attention? Well, my guess is that formal language may survive among the dropouts. In California, bookstores are regarded as subversive centers. The underground press is written by and for dropouts. The hippies have discovered print, something totally new to them. They didn't discover it in their homes, of course, and they never really encountered it in school. They discovered it outside when they turned to print as a medium of dissent in a search for identity, a social protest. Now, they haven't been able to express themselves particularly well with it, but it may well be that this whole thing will turn out to be something much more than just a put-on, and it's entirely possible that literature is going to survive outside the classroom. I can give you a very simple illustration of this. When Constantinople fell, its scholars fled west and they carried their manuscripts with them. And they were accepted in the monastery, given menial tasks, the way German scholars in the 30s were accepted here. And Western scholars, to read these manuscripts, had to learn Greek. And so they encountered, for the first time, the classics and the original. They not only read Aristotle, which hitherto had been known to them only through imperfect Latin translation, but they had available suddenly a whole library, a humanistic library. And it was that library, perhaps more than anything else, that served to harness the Renaissance technology to human ends. Well, today, when our colleges have fallen to the CIA and to schools of social work and weapons development, and let's not for a moment underestimate this. You know, people think of Clark Kerr, the great scholar. Last year, the University of California's budget, $315 million came from the Pentagon and $292 million came from Sacramento. That's new ownership. And Clark Kerr, with all the smooth phrases and so forth, sold the University of California to the Pentagon. It was done very quietly and simply. So now people, in a sense, 65% of the college presidents in California come from phys ed. Now, really, what are you going to do with that when the dropouts are reading Elizabethan poetry and Greek drama? I could tell you endless stories about these idiots who are the sweatshirt, locker room type. You know, they walk around in short pants with a basketball catch, this sort of thing. And they're thought eminently suited for this type of responsibility because, after all, the whole place is a holding system. They're wardens. They're there to keep noses clean and cigarette butts off the grass. They're perfect for it. And so scholarship has left that area, is fled from it. And I suspect that school authorities would be as amused by this notion that literature would survive with the dropouts as the Muslim conquerors must have been when they saw these tattered monks fleeing with their battered manuscripts, never once suspecting that they were taking the true treasures of Constantinople with them. Well, the time has run out. We'll continue the course at our next meeting.